today I'm very pleased to welcome Tommy Erickson to serve, who for many years has been part of the AV initiative to serve. And he's going to be talking about Particle Accelerator to serve, an overview of past, present, and future machines. So welcome, Tommy.
Thank you. So coming from CERN, of course, these days you should talk about LHC only, but since I'm working with antiproton decelerator, I have also to add that. So that's why I called the talk Particle Accelerators at CERN. So it's mainly it's going to be about the AD and the LHC. I think it is. Can you hear me? How about this? I can't stand like this, can I? Have some more gain. How about that then? Is that working? How about that? Great. Oh, that's better. I can hear it now. All right. For those of you who are not familiar with CERN, this was founded in 1952 as a council. And it should be called today OERN because it was transformed to an organization 2 years later. But CERN is much easier to say, so that name stays. It was one of the first one of the first joint ventures in Europe. And today there's 20 member states and about 2,500 employees. And this is the map of Europe. So basically all of Western Europe except Ireland and Luxembourg are members. And since the 90s or so, we have some of the ex-Eastern Bloc states joining, like Poland, Hungary, Bulgaria, and so on. So that's 20 these days. This is the geographical location. CERN is on the border between France in white and Switzerland in yellow. And this is the outline on a 27-kilometer circumference LHC. You can see it goes over the border, or rather under the border, many, many times. And this is the map. You can see the Geneva Lake and the little quaint city of Geneva here at the end. And on a good day like this, you could see the top of the Mont Blanc, which is the highest mountain in Europe. There's 20 member states, but there's also a thing called observer state or observer organization. These observers, they can attend the council meetings. And they can take part in the documents produced there, but they cannot take part in any decisions or so on. And there's also other 34 other states participating in various CERN programs. And all in all, there's about 8,000 scientists, about half of the world's particle physicists, coming from 508 universities and 85 different countries. So this is just a quick list of the history highlights, starting in 54, the first accelerator, the SC, cyclotron, 57. The PS, the first synchrotron, started in 59 and is still running today. There were some inventions, Charpak with the MWPC, who got a Nobel Prize not that many years ago. The first colliding beams, the intersecting storage rings, was commissioned in 1971. And 73, neutral currents were discovered, who later gave the idea for the discovery of the WNSZ, the neutral one, the carriers of the weak force. 76, the SPS, the first large underground machine, started to run. This is 6 kilometers in circumference, 450 GeV. 83, discovery of WNSZ, and two Nobel Prizes for some physicists the following year. And then the 27-kilometer tunnel that today houses LHC was built for the LEP, the Large Electron Positron Ring, which started in 89. And one thing one have to remember to mention is that the World Wide Web originated at CERN quite a long time ago by now. And from 93, there's a little bit of talk about antimatter as well. The first antihydrogen atoms were produced in flight, 95. There was about 9 or 10 of them or something like that. 2002, large number of antihydrogen atoms can be created in AD. And we're 50 years old, more than 50 years old, and we're eagerly awaiting the LHC startup this year. This is just an overview of the CERN accelerators. If we look at the injectors for the LHC, we start with a with the source here in front of the LINAC2, which is a linear accelerator. There's a booster, there's a PS, proton synchrotron. You use the SPS before you go into the LHC. So for the LHC proton beams, you start with 90 kV beam coming out from a dual plasmatron. And the LINAC2, 50 MeV. The booster, 1.4 GeV. PS, 25 GeV. SPS, 450. And then LHC, finally, 7 TeV collider. This is the LINAC2. This is an Alvarez structure. This machine is in operation since 72 or something like that. It's made out of three parts, three vacuum tanks, and it's got drift chamber of increasing length inside as the particles accelerate and speed up. And you can see the feed through here, which feeds power to the focusing quadrupoles that are inside it. Then we have some other old machines. This is the PS booster in between the LINAC and the PS, and as you can see, this is actually four superposed rings. This is a 1.4 GeV machine, and it was installed between the LINAC and the PS to be able to increase the intensity of the injected beam. Some more old black and white pictures. This is from the very beginning of the PS, sometime late 50s, and this is one of the 100 main bending magnets in the PS. And this is a so-called combined function magnet. You can see the vacuum pipe here. And if you look at the pole faces, you can see they're curved. So it's actually a combination of half a quadrupole and a dipole. So the PS circumference is more or less covered, completely filled up with these dipoles. And then we go on to the big machine. The SPS is still a classical warm magnet machine. You can still see the different components, quadrupole and a dipole. But when you come to an LHC, it looks like a sewage pipe once everything is closed up. So it's a 60 centimeter big tube. So now we come into the first part, the antiproton program. This started back in 1980, around there, when we built a first ring called the antiproton accumulator. This is a storage ring for antiprotons at 3.57 GeV/c. And you need stochastic cooling, stochastic stacking, to be able to accumulate antiprotons, be able to cool them. The peak number of stored antiprotons at that time was 10 to the 12, and this was used in the 1980s for the PP-bar collider experiments in the SPS, who helped discover the WNZ particles at that time. And at this era, there was also another small ring called LAIR, Low Energy Antiproton Ring Belt, to study antimatter at lower energies. Now, this went very well. The 80s was really the heyday of the antiproton facility. So, 86, there was a second ring added to the complex, and this was a collector ring with a much larger acceptance. So, you can inject a lot more of the antiprotons coming from the target. And with this, we managed to tenfold the production rate, and the maximum was 6 to the 10 PBOS per hour. The SPS collider runs continued at this time, and this was also when we saw the first H-bars in the LAIR machine. This is the way it looked at the dismantling stage in 98. We see the inner ring here is the accumulator, and the outer one is the collector. And this was all built in the same building, so it's really tight with space here. You have the red quadrupoles and the blue dipoles, and you can see various vacuum equipment and kicker tanks and so on. Now, this all came to a halt when the LHC was going to be built. We had to scale down, and to simplify the way we produced antiprotons at that time, the accumulator was removed, and we converted this collector ring, the outer ring, to a decelerator to be able to feed low-energy antiprotons directly to a few of the experiments that survived. So these are basically experiments that trap antiprotons in penning traps. We decelerate from 3.5 GeV over C to 100 MeV over C, which is a factor 36 in momentum, so this is quite a large span. And just the main experiments of the AD, which are housed inside the building, we have a trap and alpha, production and study of trapped H-bars. ASAXA, they do also study H-bars, trapped H-bars, but they do some other things, like some exotic antiprotonic helium atoms, spectroscopy and other studies on that. There's a small experiment called ACE, which studied the biological effect of PBAS on cells, grown cells, and this is in view of possible use in the medical field for treatment of tumors. And we have a fifth experiment that's proposed, and this is to study the gravitational behavior of HBAS producing light at low energies. So this is the way it looks. Today we have the hall, and up to the left that's the target area. We have an iridium target. We take primary beam with 26 GeV protons from the PS, and the yield is about 4×10⁻⁶, so it's a very inefficient way of producing antimatter, which is the only one. We can also take higher intensity beams backwards, counter-rotating for diagnostic purposes and setups and stuff like that. The ring is composed of four dispersion-free straight sections where you want to install your beam cooling systems as well as radio frequency diagnostic systems. And we have the arcs, the four arcs, where we have chromaticity correction and dispersion suppression. Stochastic cooling, I will come to that in a second. We have a pickup on one side and a kicker on the other side. There's also an electron cooler. And finally, the experimental area, which houses the experiments. We eject fast extraction only, no slow spills, so fast extraction into the experimental areas. So the basic parameters of the AD, it's 182 meters circumference. We take 1.5×10⁻¹³ protons per cycle. We get about 5×10⁷ PBAS produced. I mentioned the beam momenta, top and bottom energies. And we apply stochastic cooling at two energy levels and electron cooling at two lower energy levels. The transverse emittances vary greatly. You cool the beam down from 200 pi millimeter mean radian to 1. And this is because you completely fill the acceptance of the machine with the particles coming from the target. We also have a large spread in energy from 6% to 10⁻⁴. The average ring pressure is about 4×10⁻⁰ torr. And we have a cycle repetition rate of 1.5 minutes and 85% deceleration efficiency. Now the challenges with the AD, first of all, of course, efficient PBAR production. And then during the deceleration, you need to compress the beam, you need to cool it before decelerating. Otherwise, you will blow up in the transverse space and also in the momentum spread, the longitudinal space. So horizontal, vertical, longitudinal. You can imagine a six-dimensional phase space. You need to compress the beam by factor 10⁻¹ using beam cooling. Another challenge is beam instrumentation. It's a little bit marginal with a few 10⁻⁷ particles, which is a very, very small current. And also to convert a ring designed as a storage ring with fixed energy, to convert that to a decelerator, we have stability problems, trajectory and orbit problems at low energies. We are limited on the speed we can ramp down, and so on. And of course, the vacuum system for circulating beams at low energies, you need pretty good vacuum pressure. So this needed to be improved. So PBAR production with available 26 GeV proton beam, you have optimum yield at about 3 to 4 GeV. So 3.6 was chosen. Yes, we have 10⁻³ or so protons on the target, 50 million antiprotons. Produce, and this is a production target. There's a thin rod of iridium. It's water cooled. It's about 3 millimeters in diameter, about 10 centimeters long. And once we have a beam hitting there, it needs focusing. This is another invention by one of the physicists at CERN. He got a Nobel Prize. It's called a magnetic horn. You push a strong current pulse through here, 400 kiloamps, 6 kilovolts or something like that. And then you make it return in an outer cylinder, and the particles inside the hole here will not see any field. But if you're outside, you will see the field, and you will focus in all directions. And by playing around with the shape of it, you can actually define a focal point further downstream. This is called magnetic horn. Next challenge, of course, beam compression. This is... First of all, I mentioned we have two beam cooling systems, stochastic and electron, but to be able to fit this 6% energy spread into the acceptance of the stochastic cooling system, We do something we call bunch rotation in the longitudinal phase space using an RF system, 10 megahertz, 1 megavolt RF system, which looks like this. These are two cavities, one after the other. And if you look at this, we have time or bunch length on x-axis and energy spread on the y-axis. We are lucky that from the proton machine, from the PS accelerator, we get the production beam in the form of four very short bunches, which means by applying this voltage here for 90 degrees in this phase space diagram and then turning it off after we have rotated 90 degrees, you reduce the momentum spread enough to more or less fit into the stochastic Pauli acceptance. Once we've done that, we can apply the stochastic cooling, and this is an invention by Simon van der Meer, who used to work in the it was called the AAC team at the time, in the 1980s. He got a Nobel Prize, 84, for stochastic cooling, magnetic horn, and various other contributions to accelerator physics. Aim of stochastic cooling, reduction of emittances, increase of phase-based density. So what you have a pickup, electrostatic device, and a kicker, same thing. This should be put 90 degrees apart in this phase space here, x prime. And you can detect a position error, and you can correct the angle here. This will rotate 90 degrees. And by applying this on several consecutive machine turns, you can actually reduce the size of the beam. The thing is, you need a few things. You need a large system bandwidth. This is the case today in AD, but we used to run up to 3 gigahertz system bandwidth. In the AD, we also have cryogenic cooling on some of the components to reduce the thermal noise of the electronics. We also have the structures for the pickups and the kickers. They actually move to follow the beam as it shrinks in size. So this is the case with one particle. You can imagine you cut up the beam in very thin slices. We can call it a sample slice. But of course, have only one particle in each slice, you would need a lot more bandwidth than mentioned here. So imagine a selection of particles. You will always have a mean position here, which you can correct from here to here. And then you've done a correction one turn, but the next turn you want to have something called mixing. So you want to mix the particle population between each sample slice. So you get a new selection with a different distribution. So you can apply consecutive corrections. And this is the way the structures look. This is a microwave structure. It's a slot line structure with a geometry adapted to the velocity of the beam. So you combine the signals from this little antennas, let's say. And the kickers look exactly the same. And in real life, it looks something like this. You have a vacuum tank with a backup equipment. We have the transmission lines coming from the pickup. And of course, you have to be careful to pull them straight across the machine hole to be able to get the correction signal there in time, because the particles move by almost the speed of light. We can also see some of the mechanics here used for the movement of the inner structures as they follow the beam size. And this is an example of momentum cooling. You can see the momentum spread decreasing as time goes on. So this is to explain a little bit more. The cooling rate depends on a number of things. Number of particles. You have a lot of particles, it's a little slower. And the bandwidth of the system has to be as large as possible. But the interesting thing here is that they decide mixing. So between the kicker and the pickup, you want to mix the particles around between the samples. But between the pickup and the kicker, you want to conserve your population in the sample slice. So you have to arrange your optics of the ring to have ideal conditions, or as ideal as possible. So stochastic cooling in a nutshell. Now, stochastic cooling works pretty well at higher energies in AD. The systems we used, they were used at the storage energy, injected energy. But at lower energies, they weren't very well adopted. So we found an old electron cooler sitting around at CERN from the Lear ring. This is the same thing, increase the phase-space density, cool the beam. But here, it's you mix an electron beam with the antiprotons, and it's just like mixing on two two gases with different temperatures and you end up heating up the electrons and cooling the antiprotons. And of course, the electron beam is renewed continuously, so you always get a fresh new beam coming in. This is the way schematic look. You have a thermocathode somewhere up here. It's a 30 kilovolt, 2 amps electron beam coming down here, nicely focused through here, and this is the interaction region. And also with 60 kilowatt of electrons, you need a collector. There's a collector here, and you recycle it through the power supply. There's a solenoid magnet covering the whole thing. And this is well suited for the lower energies. If you go higher in beam energies, you need really a lot of really high voltages, the high energy of the electrons, which is somehow difficult to do. And it looks like this in real life. You can see the cathode is here, interaction region. Collector on the other side. But the toroids here, which are used to deviate electrons to follow this line here, they also disturb the antiproton beam a little bit. But of course, antiprotons are much heavier than electrons, so the disturbance is small. But we need quite a few dipole correctors here to compensate for this effect. And this is just a schematic of the insert of the electron cooler. You have triplets, quadruple triplets on each side. And you also need compensating solenoids to compensate for the main solenoidal field here, which affects the beam optics. Electron cooling speed depends on a few things. The relative difference in angle between the antiprotons and the electrons, this angle cubed. You have this parameter, which is the length of the interaction region of the cooler over the length of the machine. And these here, mass charge and relativistic factors. So low energy beams are lighter. You want a long cooler, short ring, high electron current, and small initial emittances. So it will cool slowly in the beginning and faster as the cooling works. So this is the way it's set up, the deceleration cycle. It's about 90 seconds long. And these cooling processes, they take a fair amount of time, 15, 20 seconds each time. And the two flat parts of the cycles for stochastic cooling and two more for electron cooling. And in real life, it looks something like this. This is a recording of an AD cycle where we inject the beam here. This signal here is a DSP-treated signal from a longitudinal Schottky pickup. So you can see on the x-axis frequency spread of the resolution beam and the intensity on the y-axis. The frequency spread is means also momentum spread. You can see during the flat tops that you reduce your momentum spread. So here we come down to 2 GV over C, which is the second part of the stochastic cooling. And the jump from 2 GV over C here to 300 MeV over C is a factor 7 in momentum. This is a little bit marginal. We do have some beam losses down here. But this was the highest energy we could apply this, the electron cooling. And now we're cooling with electrons at 300 MeV over C. Things still look fairly stable and good. And in a few seconds, we're going to go down to the lowest energy, where things are getting a little bit unstable. It takes some time for the electron beam to stabilize at the lower settings. And also for the main fields of the ring, it takes a fair amount of time. You can see here the beam is wandering all over the place, but after a few seconds it will end up in the middle. So this is what the AD user sees all the time, and this is a very good diagnostic tool. It's kicked out. So that's it, almost it for the AD, and then we send it off to our users, the experimenters. I'm not going to talk anything at all about the physics, except this is a very schematic view of a penning trap. And you have a solenoidal magnet covering the outside here, and there's a number of electrodes which defines a potential well. You inject the beam from the left here, for example, and you just reduce this voltage on this one. The beam goes in. We start to spiral around here due to the solenoid, and it will bounce from this electrode, and before it comes back, you just increase the voltage here again. So the antiproton bunch will bounce forwards and backwards and spiral at the same time. So We also have some future plans for the AD, some improvements. If you look carefully, you see a little ring here called Elena. This could be placed between the existing extraction lines here and the experimental areas. And this ring will increase the trapping efficiency into these penning traps. Today we have bead coming directly from the AD, and it goes through degrader foils because you cannot easily trap particles with 5 MeV kinetic energy. Down to 100 or so, we could imagine decelerating a small ring. And the idea is to have yet another electron cooler in this ring when we decelerate, so we can cool and increase the density of the beam. So for alpha and ATRAP, we hope to have 2 orders of magnitude improvement. And as it says here, most of the beam is thrown away in these degrader folds, which causes the beam to blow up. At SACSO, they have a little bit different scheme for deceleration than using radio frequency quadruple decelerator, but they will still gain 1 order of magnitude thanks to electron cooler. And 100 kV kinetic energy is just about as low as you can go with this ring. And they will still need degrader foils, but much, much thinner. So we have a few parameters of the ELENA. 25 meter circumference. The intensity is limited by space charge effects, which is something that tends to blow up the beam at low energies. So we hope to be able to have 1 × 10⁷ particles with reasonably small transverse emittances. And of course the requirements for the vacuum here is much higher than in the AD. We need a few 10⁻¹² torus. And it will also have deceleration cycle, much cooler. We can inject and we can decelerate without initial cooling because the beam is still fairly small coming from the AD. We have 2 flat parts of the cycle for electron cooler. Now this is a very interesting project, if ever it sees the day. It's ultra-low energy antiprotons in circulating machine and electron cooling at very low energies. There's like 50-100 volts electron beam or something like that. It's very low. However, CERN's main program today is LHC and LHC physics to build this. It costs money, so this has to be a collaboration between CERN and the AD users at 50-50. So the users are actively looking for funding. And if they can find 50% or something like that, we might get approved by CERN. So it'll take 3.5 years to design and build and commission this machine. So I believe that's all about AD. Now we go to the other end of the energy scale, the LHC. Overview and status. Of course, high luminosity for ATLAS and CMS. I understand a fair amount of people here are involved with ATLAS. There's a change on technology from LEP to LHC. I mean, they're in the same tunnel. It's a completely change of magnet technology, superconductivity, and cryogenics comes into play. There's some challenges, accelerator physics challenges, beam optics, synchrotron radiation, electron cloud effects, beam effects, collimation. And also for the injector chain, it's very important to keep dense beams, i.e. preserve transverse emittances, and also generation of a certain longitudinal structure to have optimum luminosity in this collider. So LHC, 27 kilometer circumference. You have 2 beam pipes, and there is, for the moment, that's 4 interaction points where the 2 counter-rotating proton beams can be brought into collision. And the rest of the time, they have separate beam pipes. So there's 2 main experiments that are looking for the Higgs, ATLAS and CMS. There's also a few other experiments to verify TOTEM, something is called up here, to verify the proton-proton cross-section. There's also some beauty quark physics and quark gluon plasma physics. So there's a number of initial experiments, at least. Things can change. This is an interaction point in ATLAS. We can see the beams are being squeezed and being brought into a collision. There's 1 vertical interaction point and crossing angles in ATLAS and horizontal in CMS. And the most important thing of all for a collider is the luminosity. And the luminosity is defined as the number of events you observe over the cross section, which is the probability, more or less. So the dominance depends on the machine parameters, nothing else. The important things for the luminosity, number of particles per bunch, number of bunches per beam, resolution frequency, relativistic gamma, beam size, and also you get some reduction due to the crossing angle at the interaction point. And the peak luminosity for both ATLAS and CMS, we hope for, is 10 to the 37 per square centimeter a second. Some of the basic parameters for the LHC, there's about 10 to the 11 particles per bunch, 2,800 bunches rotating per beam, so this is times 2, of course, 11 megahertz revolution frequency, 70 TeV beams, and very small beta at the collision points. Transverse emittances about 3.75 micrometers, and this geometric reduction factor 0.84, and this F here depends on the crossing angle, depends on the bunch length, and also the transverse beam size. And of course the real figure of merit is the integrated luminosity over the year we run per year, and we expect to have something like 80 to 120 inverse femtobonds in 1 year. Now we're only interested in the inelastic events, of course. This is what really an event is. We saw 10 to the 34 luminosity, and multiplied by this cross section, we expect something like 600 million events per second for each experiment. And you can look at this as another way. The bunch spacing is about 25 nanoseconds, so this means the crossing rate, collision rate of the bunches at 40 megahertz. It's a little bit less in real life because not all the buckets are filled with particles. There are holes in the bunch trains to allow for injection and ejection kickers in the injector chain. So we have an effective crossing rate of 30 megahertz or so. And we also already said we had 600 million events per second. So what you will see for each collision, each crossing, we expect 19 inelastic events. So per year will be 6×10^15. You can imagine the amount of data needs to be stored from the detectors. But this is needed because to find Higgs, it's something like this: one event in 10^13. So maybe with a bit of luck, 1,000 events, Higgs events per year. So this is just very basic. Two of the expected Higgs events in ATLAS, high and low luminosity, so either two gammas, opposing direction, or four muons. So this is something they will look for. An overview of the ATLAS detector. This is just to show the size. You can see the little person standing here. And you have the different layers of detector, muon detector, calorimeters. You have the big end plates, end cap toroid. And I won't go into this at all because it's not really accelerated technology. But swiftly moving along to superconductivity and cryogenics, this is an overview of the tunnel which was used for the LEP before. And the only modification needed was to do two transfer tunnels between the SPS and LHC, and two new access points. So we have 8 access points around the ring. Now, if you compare LEP and LHC, you quickly realize that with the difference in energy, the bending radius is a little bit smaller in LHC, i.e. we have longer straight sections. But we will, by looking at this formula here, we quickly find we need 8 Tesla or something. And this you cannot really do with normal magnets. The LEP bending magnets in comparison had very low fields. You can normally go to 1.5 Tesla or so in wall magnets in accelerators. But due to synchrotron radiation, an electron machine is very, very different. So 8 Tesla superconducting magnets. This is cross-sections of the dipoles and the quadrupoles. And this is something here called the cold mass, which is at 1.9 Kelvin. And it's cooled by liquid superfluid helium. The quadrupoles look more or less the same. And you can see the dipolar coils here and the quadrupolar coils. You also have the bus bars, both for the dipoles and quadrupoles. They had to go straight through the string of magnets. And you have the heat shields, insulation shields, and so on. This is a nice picture of one of the magnets. They're about 15 meters long, 37 tons, and the price is about half a million Swiss franc each. 70 EV beams, 8.33 Tesla. It's almost 12 kiloamps, and its stored energy is about 7 megajoules. And to make up all these coils, you need superconducting cables, and this cable is something like 20 millimeters across and maybe 5 millimeters thick. It's made out of 36 or something strands, and each strand have lots of little filaments inside. A strand being a little bit less than a millimeter, and it has 6,000 something niobium titanium filaments, 6 micrometers thick. Around each filament, that's half a micrometer layer of copper, and this works as an insulation material in the superconductive state. But warmer temperatures is a conductor both for current and for heat. So there's about 1,200 tons of superconducting cable in here, which is about 7,600 kilometers. So if you look at each filament and put one after the other, you can go to the sun 5 times and back. This is just a list of all the magnets in the LHC, superconducting magnets to this. You have about 1,200 of the main magnets, the dipoles, and 400 or so quadrupoles. And there's various extra for the low beta insertion, for the squeeze insertions at the interaction regions. And you also have multipoles and so on for optical reasons. Most of this are combined with the main magnets. Much shorter coils. And this is a picture of one of the shafts at the access points when the magnets were installed. This is in 2005, and at one stage we had about 1,000 dipoles stored anywhere possible at CERN, indoors or outdoors. If you've ever been flying across CERN in 2006, you could see these blue 50-meter tubes from far, far. Or there were hundreds of them stored anywhere, any field you can imagine. And it was all finished, the installation, but 2 years later, 400 man years or so for the Cryostat installation, the cold test of the whole cryo system, 600 man years, and to transport the magnets was about 30,000 kilometers done at about 2 kilometers per hour. And this is the way it looks in the tunnel. And two magnets here with some bellows in the middle, the superconducting cables here which needs splicing very carefully, and you have the interconnect between two dipoles. Cryogenics. I mentioned superfluid helium, of course, which is an excellent heat conductor. And operating temperature is 1.9 Kelvin. And all in all, there's about 40,000 connections, pipe connections, that need to be leak tight. Superfluid helium is very prone to leak because it has no viscosity. So this is very, very, very careful. And then the initial cool down, you cool down from room temperature to about 80 Kelvin using nitrogen, liquid nitrogen. You need about 12 million liters. I think this is something like 60 truckloads full of liquid nitrogen. 31,000 tons of material, and there will be a helium inventory of 700,000 liters. And of course, the helium is recycled, recovered in the case of quenches as much as possible. And this is the cryo system distribution line, where part of these 40,000 leak tight connections are made. I'm not saying there were no problems with this. There have been many, many occasions there have been modifications and repair of leaks. So now we come to the next chapter, challenges in accelerator physics. You need a flexible lattice to allow further upgrades and stuff like that. And also synchrotron irradiation comes into play here, because this is the first proton machine at energy sufficiently high that synchrotron radiation comes into play. Which means you will heat up, you will lose particles due to synchrotron radiation, you will heat up the beam pipe and also create photoelectrons when you collide with the vacuum chamber walls and so on. And this can have significant effects on the beam with limited intensity. Collective effects, non-linearities due to electron cloud buildup, and also beam effect when you have bunches passing each other, they affect each other. This will also limit intensity and density. And you have to be careful when you have a superconducting machine, it can quench just a little bit of heat load from a few lost particles will be enough to quench superconducting magnet. So this is an overview of the rings. We see the beam optics layout. You have 8 arcs. This blue here is 8 long straight sections. These little yellow things, blue here as well, about 500 meters long. This is where you put the interaction points. You put beam dump, radio frequency systems, and also something you call momentum and betatron cleaning. This is collimation of the beam. You put in collimators very close to the beam to scrape off the high amplitude particles. There are so-called dispersion suppressors. It means that you want particles with different energy, you want them to have the same orbit in the straight sections, so you need to have separated orbit at the curved sections. And 4 main experiments. And this is at the entrance to the interaction points, where you go from 2 beam pipes to 1. You have separation and recombination dipoles, and then you have quadruple triplets to focus the beam. These quadruple triplets, they look like this, and these are just put here because you can see both KEK and Fermilab have contributed to the LHC in kind. And the final focusing inner triplets, they are called. And these are placed somewhere here, just at the entrance to the experimental hall. Now, synchrotron radiation, this is power radiated by a particle. This is used in synchrotron light source, where you work with electrons most of the time. And electron has electrons are much lighter particles, of course. So if you look at this formula, the power radiated depends on the rest energy, total energy, and the curvature radius, basically. So U0 here will be the energy radiated per revolution, and the average power, P average. So basically, rest mass, total energy, and bending radius. If you compare LEP and LHC, LEP towards the end of its lifespan was running as 104 GeV we're seeing, and this was a sort of desperate last attempt to find Higgs at energy. This is just at the beginning where you can maybe hope to find Higgs. So we were running, pushing it higher and higher in energy, and at the end every single free space on the LEP circumference was filled with radio frequency. And this you needed because there was an enormous loss of beam energy due to synchrotron radiation, which amounts to about 3% of the total beam energy per turn. So this is humongous. This is really 3.3 GeV beam loss, beam energy loss per turn. In the LHC, of course, it's a proton machine, so it's much less. But still, the average over one revolution is about 4 kilowatts. So this has severe effects, especially when you consider you have superconducting magnets. So therefore, something called a beam screen was included in design, and this is to intercept the heat generated by this by the particles hitting the walls and take it away. And of course, you need to still pump the vacuums. You need to put slots in it, and these slots, they will modify the impedance of the wall. We have your image current, you have the beam going one way and an image current, the same structure, going the other way. So as soon as you mess around with a nice smooth shape of the beam pipe, you will easily run into problems for high intensity, high energy beams. So this is called a beam screen. And also when you have particles hitting the walls, you will get something with photo emission. Here, a photoelectron will be generated, but unfortunately, you'll have these very intense proton bunches going past, and they will accelerate these electrons, and you might end up with a sort of cascade of events which increases the number of electrons. This can happen at various places, and this is a cloud of electrons, and if you push a beam, high density beam through, you might have problems with the coherent instabilities and blow up this old proton beam. This is one of the consideration. There's a number of solutions to this. You can have the chambers of the inside of the vacuum chamber fabricated in a sort of sawtooth pattern to change the angle of the secondary emission. And you can also have low emission coatings on the inside of the vacuum chamber and things like this. Another problem, possible problem, is beam-beam interaction. Of course, you need a crossing angle at the interaction regions. And since most of the particles are not generating events, they will just go past each other and they will affect each other. But there's also long range when it's still in the same vacuum pipe, but further away from each other. This can generate all sorts of problems, limiting the density and the intensity you can achieve. There's also another thing I mentioned, in the bunch train that fills the LHC, there's also holes to allow for injection and ejection kickers in the injector. So at some occasions you might have a bunch in one of the beams, but not on the other. So different bunches will actually behave differently, and you can have different problems due to that. Collimation, so here's the energy of the stored beam. If you look at the previous accelerators, SPS, LHC at injection, the Tevatron, HERA, SPS collider. LHC is somewhere up here. Stored beam energy of about 360 megajoules at 7 TeV. So 360 megajoules, I understand, it's something like a jetliner, the energy of a jetliner at full speed. So beam collimation is fairly important. And we have collimators at momentum and longitudinal, betatron. So this is carbon jaws that you can move. They have to be about 2 millimeters away from the beam edge. And you also have to make sure you have electrical continuity for the image current running along the outside. Vacuum systems, it's not only one, but there's three vacuum systems. Thermal insulation, this is the best way of thermal insulation, is vacuum for the cryomagnets, cryosystems, and also for the distribution line, and finally the beam vacuum for the machine itself. So this is the requirements driven by beam lifetime and also for the background in the experiments. So somewhere a little bit in the same range as the AD, 10 to the minus 10, 10 to the minus 11 millibar. Another problem, of course, if you don't want a jetliner crashing into your superconducting magnets that you paid $500,000 Swiss francs each. So if something goes wrong, you have to have an efficient beam dumping system. Here you have the two counter-rotating beams. So you have a kicker, right, a detection system, first of all, of course, and a kicker, and various magnets that in the vertical, on the inside, here you will have a vertical deflection and you will actually kick out the beam above the circulating beam into the beam dump and in a horizontal direction on the outside trajectory. And due to all this stored energy in the beam, you also have a system that spreads out the beam as it's being dumped. So you distribute the heat load on the dumps. So there's about 700 meters from here to there. Now this is just a recap of the accelerators used. We went from the Duo Plasmatron 90 kV to the Linac 2 50 MeV to the Booster 1.4 GV, PS 25 GV, SPS 450 GV, finally to the LHC 7 TeV. Emittance conservation, of course, is very important in this whole chain. In the LINAC 2, we have a square pulse with a variable length, 100 microseconds or so. At the injection into the booster, 180 milliamp on beam current, 30 microseconds long. And here we have transverse emittances of about 1 micrometer. And the requirements for the LHC is about 3.75 micrometers. And to go through 4 or 5 accelerators, injection, ejection, all sorts of manipulation, acceleration, this is really a challenge to have only 50% transverse blow up. This also in the longitudinal sense, there's a bunch, you have to generate a bunch train, and this is looking in one of the accelerators, the PS, you inject bunches and then you split them up by manipulating your different RF systems. There's several different RF cavities used, and it's called bunch splitting when you change the harmonics on one cavity after the other and you step up. And this is done in this way to reduce the emittance blow up, the longitudinal emittance blow up, because if you debunch and rebunch the beam every time at different harmonics in each of the accelerators, you will end up with a lot more blow up. So finally, we have, this is much better. This is actually one of the PS cycles, 3.6 seconds long. We inject that into the SPS. And as you can see, the final beam here with 2,800 bunches in the LHC, it has long and short poles. And this is, if you go back to the beam effects, this will probably create some funny effects as well. The total filling time for the LHC is like 8.5 minutes. Remember, it's two beams, counter-rotating. And this is the operational nominal cycle. Superconducting magnet, you can't ramp them very fast at all. You have to be careful to dump your beam properly before you decelerate, otherwise you would melt your machine down. And we have ramp-down times of 18 minutes or so, and it's minutes and minutes and minutes. But if you calculate, you maybe need 2 hours or so to set up the machine and tune things and inject a new beam. The projected coasting time is 10 to 20 hours before it's time to dump the beam and fill again. Now a little bit of the status and where we are. The two transfer lines between the SPS and the LHC, one here, one there, the two new lines, they have been commissioned and finished in 2004, one of them, and in 2007, the other in October. So this is the transverse beam profile. This is the first sector test, sector 7-8. There's 8 sectors in LHC, and the first cool down and powering of the magnets. And you can see we started somewhere here in January and finished in July. And there were a number of problems, of course. First of all, this is the very first cooldown of any part of the LHC machine. So to stabilize this very low temperature here, it took some time. And then we ran into some problems with the feed boxes. The feed boxes, the power connections to the magnets. We have not only the electricity to go through, but there's also a difference in temperature of 250 Kelvin or something like that. So it wasn't until May or something we could start powering up the magnets, and this was finished in July, and then warm up again. The second sector was done, sector 4-5. We hoped for a little bit better results, but this time we ran into other problems. 2 occasions vacuum leaks, and 1 occasion with the refrigeration station, and it was a little bit faster July to November, but Not all that much faster. This maybe we can skip, but well, actually maybe not. Quench training. Superconducting magnet needs training. You have the temperature, and a quench is when you have a local generation of heat, and then the liquid refrigerant will start to evaporate, and then you have a massive expansion. There's a safety system that opens valves to avoid damage to mechanical pressure, And there's also a recycling system to recover this expensive helium. And each of the 1600 magnets is also equipped with not only the quench protection system, but it's also equipped with something called a post-mortem system, which logs all the magnet parameters, so you can go back and look what happens at a quench. But in practical, in the control room, it looks like this. You go higher and higher in current, and you hope that the quench is going to be less and less serious. So the temperature rise is not all that much. And it's also, this is where we use this post-mortem system. Quench propagation, of course, this heat will propagate and make other magnets quench. And before you have been able to ramp down the magnet, you have four or five magnets quenched. And you can see here that it started at this magnet, and then a certain time later, these magnets quenched. But at the time, the current was much lower, and the amount of energy dissipated was coming down more and more. So every single magnet needs to be trained in this way. Life cycle of a sector before beam. This is each of the eight sectors. Installation, interconnections, leak tests, pressure tests, flushing. This is done for all the eight sectors of the LHC. And then cool down and powering tests. I just showed it's been done for two sectors, but both of these sectors needed warming up again afterwards due to technical problems of various nature. And this is the commissioning plan. 2008, we plan to start a beam commissioning sometime end May this year. And the first physics with a simplified beam structure will start towards the end of the year, and the full-blown physics with a nominal beam at the end of 2009. And this is still the official plan, but it might slip due to various problems. So, that's it. Can you repeat that? Is that one of the experiments that? Ages, yeah. They want to compare the gravitational behavior, matter and antimatter. So it's. I don't have the numbers in my head what sort of certainty or precision they're aiming for, but until you measure the gravity of antimatter, and there's no way. It's probably going to be the same. We tried, but in the beginning of the talk I showed you the AAC, the two rings were accumulating at a crazy rate of 6 × 10 to the 10 per hour, and in the 20 odd years or so we were doing that, I think we managed to scrunch together about one nanogram, and in Dan Brown's novel I think it had about 1 gram, so you can imagine we need either a long time or lots of accelerators. I don't really know about the ILC, but in the LHC, obviously, this would be one of the limiting factors of intensity and density. The collimators, for example, that's the most important part of it. the budget for the LHC or for the AD? That's a big difference. LHC. Oh, I'm not sure I can remember it. Half a million Swiss francs per magnet, that's about 1,600. That's part of the budget, a major part of the budget. 8 billion. Yeah, I had the number 8 billion in my head, but I can't remember the currency, but so it, that's not far. The AD in 86, the price of the Accol, which was the name of the ring then, was about 80 million Swiss francs. We spent about 8 million Swiss francs in 98-99 to convert it to the decelerator. And of course now we're looking at this Elena little ring, which will be about 10 million francs plus manpower.
So much less.
Much less, yeah. Much smaller. Much smaller. There's not that much new technology in Elena. It's to have denser beams at the very low energies. The intensity is the intensity and particle flux is actually lower, but you get it back at the entrance to the panning traps.